Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 p.m. on Thursday, January 20th, 2022. Present today, we've got Representative LeBon, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, myself, Co-Chair Foster, and then online, or actually on the video conference, we've got Representative Rasmussen, and is Representative Carpenter, I think he was going to call in as well. Is he online? Not right. Okay, I think he will be though. And then Representative Thompson should also be here shortly. And so as we start, just a reminder, folks could please mute their cell phones. And today's presentation is an overview of the governor's FY23 budget. And here to present, we have Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. And thank you for joining us. And go ahead and put yourself on the record and jump right in.
All right. Good afternoon. For the record, Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. And thank you for inviting me here today to give an overview of the governor's fiscal year 23 operating budget and a bit of information about the governor's capital budget and supplemental proposals. So to start, I'd like to cover a little bit of a look back at, you know, the changes that have been made over the last several years. So between fiscal year 19 and fiscal year 23, the budget proposal in front of us today, there's been about a 5.1% reduction in overall expenditures. 5% of that comes out, or a 5% reduction of that is from the operating budget, and about 7.9% reduction in the capital budget. In the operating budget, you have about 2.2% in agency operations. Primarily, this comes from some reductions to funding for the University of Alaska, changes in the way we're able to finance activities at the Department of Transportation, and a couple of other reductions throughout agency operating budgets. But those are offset by significant investments in areas of public protection and development of natural resources. We also have a very significant reduction in statewide operations, about $146 million over this time period. Primarily, this comes from a significant reduction in the obligations to the state retirement system. We've seen very good returns in the retirement system fund, which reduces the state's obligation here. The capital budget in fiscal year 23 is primarily just covering match for federal programs. It really represents a pretty baseline capital budget. And I'll address a little bit about how we're trying to address capital needs in our budget proposal for fiscal year 23 a little bit later in my slides. But over this time period, between both these reductions in budget and slightly, you know, better available revenue in fiscal year 23, you know, we've closed the gap from a deficit of nearly $500 million in fiscal year 19 to a fiscal year 23 budget that can be accomplished without a deficit or a drawn savings.
And Mr. Steininger, I got a quick question. I think for folks watching on Gavel, they might ask, we're currently going to be working on the FY23 budget. We're currently in the FY22 fiscal year. And so the last complete budget would be, that's completed, would be FY21. And so somebody might ask, well, why did you choose FY19? Is that happen to be a year that makes everything look good? And I assume maybe that was the governor's first year, so you're looking at wanting to show what it was when he first came in versus now, or you chose FY19 because?
Yes, Chair Foster, we chose FY19 because, you know, that's a budget inherited by this administration, and so, you know, it felt most appropriate for this look back to, you know, focus on the achievements made by the administration and the changes made over our term.
Thank you. Please proceed.
And one other thing I'd like to note on, you know, this slide and kind of all the coming slides is the tables presented represent the revenue projections released on December 15th as part of the fall revenue sources book. But yesterday, the Department of Revenue released revised revenue estimates that significantly changed the revenue picture in an effort to provide kind of more current information. So where appropriate, I'll note some of those differences between the tables and what has been presented yesterday.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, Mr. Steininger, if I'm understanding this correctly, the change element, the area that's in red, is a change from FY 2019 then to FY 2023. Is that what we're looking at when we talk about the change?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, on this slide, yes. On later slides, I'll be showing just a change between fiscal year 22 and 23 to highlight the the operating and capital budget changes for this proposal here. For the purpose of this slide, we're comparing to 19.
Mr. Steininger, while we're on this slide, and I think you'll get to it in later slides, but just since we're looking at this from a high level, you've got the FY23 governor's budget with a surplus of $27 million. And of course, we heard from some of the other, our alleged finance and so forth, that that includes $375 million in ARPA COVID Fed funds, in which case the FY23 surplus might be a deficit of $350 million. I assume you'll get to that in later slides.
Chair Foster, yes. In short, we are utilizing the ability to use ARPA SLRF funding for revenue offset, which allows it to be used in place of unrestricted general funds.
Okay. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The FY22 authorized and supplemental budget, the middle column, that is supplemental that hasn't been passed yet. That's sort of hypothetical. I mean, obviously FY23 budget is what you've constructed, but the FY22 with supplemental, part of that's what we passed and part of that has not been passed yet.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that's correct. The FY22 column is proposed supplementals.
Okay, please proceed.
So as we were developing the fiscal year 23 budget, we had a handful of objectives that we were looking to achieve. One is a continuation of the governor's 50-50 permanent fund dividend proposal, including the constitutional amendment that is still before the legislature. Also trying to craft a fiscal year 23 operating budget that addresses baseline needs and priorities, looking to ensure a safe environment for individuals and businesses through investments in public protection, permitting of business activity and resource development. Also efforts to continue towards efficiency and operational change. You'll see a lot of changes in our budget that are fairly structural that we believe will help enhance the ability to operate government. And the use of fiscal year 22 surplus as well as bonding to support robust capital investment. As I said earlier, the fiscal year 23 capital budget is mostly a baseline match capital budget, but we do have an overall strategy that utilizes both bonding and money available in fiscal year 22 to achieve a lot of the capital needs before the state. As well as that, we want to avoid any deficit or draws from savings accounts in our fiscal year 23 budget, while still supporting all of these objectives. So looking a little bit closer at what's in front of us, the changes being made between 22 and 23. First, I'd like to touch on available revenues. The top portion of this chart, really, I'm sure you heard in much better detail from the Department of Revenue and earlier presentation. So I won't spend too much time on it, but it's reflecting the unrestricted general fund revenues and total revenues available to the state from both traditional sources like petroleum, non-petroleum, and investment revenue, as well as a percent of market value draw. You can see here that we're reserving 50% of that draw to pay for permanent fund dividends, and the other 50% going to government services. The difference here that I'd like to highlight, though, is the carry forward and adjustment section. This section has always appeared on fiscal summaries produced by OMB, but usually it's just limited to prior year appropriations available for expenditure in a current year, and seldom gets much attention. But in this year, we have a couple of notable differences than we have had in the past. One being the use of undesignated savings, or the SBR, through direct appropriations in fiscal year 22, and that adjusts the amount of revenue used for unrestricted general fund purposes in fiscal year 22 by $410.7 million, as well as that use of federal revenue replacement. So the terms of ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act, allow for use of the $1 billion that came to the states through the Community State Fiscal Relief Fund, or SLRF as it's called. It allows for use of that to offset revenue loss due to COVID. So effectively, that federal revenue really acts as unrestricted general fund revenue. So where we're not directly appropriating that revenue for the purpose of something directly related to COVID response, we coded in the budget as an unrestricted general fund expenditure, and then show an adjustment of revenue where that federal money is being used to offset that unrestricted general fund expenditure. So that it is really truly revenue coming into the state from the federal government used for general purposes. So again, as I mentioned earlier, these are based on the fall revenue sources book, the total of $4.6 billion in 23 and $4.9 billion in 22. However, the updates given yesterday would increase UGF revenue in 22 by $281 million and 23 by $467 million. So you can see that is a fairly significant change over 1 month, which is why the Department of Revenue released that additional information.
Can you repeat that? It's an additional how much in revenue?
An additional $467 million in 23 and $281 million in 22, listed in the very, very small print footnote on this slide.
I think they did have the caveat of saying we don't want to rely too much on monthly updates, and in the past we'd always stuck to the fall and spring forecast, and the monthly updates can just, I guess, vary quite a bit, and so maybe it makes sense to use the numbers when they're in our favor and maybe not so much when they're not, and so I just wanted maybe have folks keep that in mind. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the $1.25 billion carry forward?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl. So carry forward in fiscal year 22, the $1.25 billion is almost entirely direct federal COVID relief to departments or to state programs that was appropriated in fiscal years 20 and 21 that carried into fiscal year 22. So that's where you see that, large amount of small business relief and nonprofit relief and community relief is represented in that number.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the 250 in COVID federal revenue replacement, 250 in 22 and 375 in 23. I know we got about $1 billion, so some of it was used directly for a purpose, and then what wasn't was used for revenue replacement, and that's what I'm seeing up there. Is that it?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that's correct. So about 250 roughly was used for direct appropriations in 22, and then in our budget here, we're using 375 for revenue replacement and the rest for direct appropriations for 23.
Okay, and next I've got Representative Ortiz and then Rasmussen. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steiniger, going back to Representative Wohl's reference to the 1.25 carry forward, you mentioned direct federal relief money in the form of direct federal relief money. How much of that is just one-time money versus continuing forward money? Is it all just one time?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, at that one point, the $1.25 billion there in the carry forward line would be one-time monies that were appropriated with multiple years available for expenditure, so appropriated in 1 year, but could be, you know, expended over multiple years in the operating budget. So we have to show that adjustment to show prior year's revenue available for expenditure in fiscal year 22. But it is one-time revenues from federal government.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Sorry, I guess my question to Mr. Steiniger has more to do with the monthly forecast. I understand traditionally we've done a fall and a spring, but I'm a contractor, so my income can vary pretty significantly month to month depending on how many appraisals I do, just like our oil revenue could vary significantly based on the price per barrel. So does it seem like we would be getting more credible or accurate information by having this monthly snapshot as we realize what the oil prices are at that time? More real-time information, I guess?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I would probably defer the question on, you know, the timing of the revenue releases to the Department of Revenue. What I'll say is, you know, for the tables that we present, you know, we're presenting them based on the fall revenue forecast, and then we'll update with the spring revenue forecast. This monthly information really is because there's such a dramatic change from that fall revenue forecast, Department of Revenue felt it necessary to present that information. And so, you know, we're including it in our slides for informational purposes.
Just quick follow-up.
Representative Rasmussen.
So I guess through the chair, is it accurate to say that from a budgeting standpoint or a budgeting perspective, more up-to-date real-time information on our actual revenue helps us to understand a fuller, better picture of how much money we actually have available to spend and to budget for?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I do think it's helpful to know, you know, what current revenue collections are. You know, for planning purposes, it's always good to have up-to-date information, and, you know, especially when the information does change dramatically from when the official forecast is put out. So that is why we've included this information on our slides, just to be able to ensure that the committee has the most current information from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, same sort of topic. Mr. Steiniger, will the administration be telling us in its amendments what it proposes to do with the extra revenue? Or will we, is it just sort of a wait and see and a reason for optimism? Or are you, this PowerPoint doesn't designate, not a great use of the word, but it doesn't indicate what the administration wants to do with those funds?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you know, when we're looking at how to spend public funds, you know, we prefer to look at it from the perspective of actual operational needs or, you know, capital needs, but actual needs for expenditure and not just, you know, available revenue needing to be expended. So we're presenting this here, you know, more as a guide to the most current information about revenue, but I feel that the actual appropriations being presented are, you know, should be taken on their own merit, not necessarily just we have more revenue coming in, we should spend this $460 million. You know, that said, you know, we'll, in the traditional timeline, you know, present budget amendments for, you know, technical corrections or any new information that's come up, but it won't necessarily be based on, oh, we need to spend another $460 million. That's not necessarily a prudent way to budget. We're looking at, you know, what the true needs of the state are and trying to address those.
Follow up?
In some respects, I'm, as an individual and a legislator, I'm fine with that. But I guess it means the state could be, over the next 18 months, $700 million wealthier. And what may happen under the administration proposal is that that would just go in the general fund. And some of it would go into the permanent fund as the 25% royalty. But
We'll just save it. Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, on actually the next slide, it addresses what the surplus would end up being should these revenue projections, these updated revenue projections, you know, bear out over the two fiscal years. You know, and that surplus is, you know, a deposit back into the general fund and then eventually, you know, swept into the CBR per the terms of the Constitution.
Please proceed.
So looking at the expenditure side of the fiscal summary, you know, here you can see a change in total operating of about 2% of an increase between fiscal year 22 and fiscal year 23. That's broken down into a couple of different categories. In agency operations, roughly flat, a $14 million increase. Really here you see a decrease in agency non-formula, so general operations, day-to-day operations of state government agencies, and an increase in agency formula spending. So that would be, you know, the large formula programs like Medicaid or K-12 education combined had a net increase of about $36 million. One other thing to note within this is accommodated within that $21.8 million reduction are increases to cover the cost of programs that used to be covered with designated general funds that were then swept. And so that decrease, you know, really, you know, accommodates another increase in some of the obligations to the general fund. On the statewide operations side, you see a much larger increase of about $90 million. Primarily, this is coming from oil and gas tax credits, which are about $199 million per the statutory calculation in fiscal year 23. And that's significantly higher than the amount that was appropriated in fiscal year 22. That's offset considerably by a large reduction in retirement system obligations. Like any fund, the retirement system saw very good earnings over the last year, which reduced our liability into that fund, as well as the other policy decision by the ARM board to not fund the overfunded health portion of the retirement system. So at the bottom line for, or that brings you to the $103 million in operating change. On the capital side, we have a reduction. This reduction of $88.2 million is primarily because the fiscal year 23 capital budget represents really a match-only core need capital budget, and we're trying to achieve capital needs elsewhere. So before you count supplementals, the change in the total operating and capital budget is up by just under $15 million, or, you know, rounding out to 0% change. So effectively a flat budget between fiscal year 22 and 23. And that leaves us with a surplus of $26.7 million based on the fall forecast. If you were to adjust for those revenue adjustments released by the Department of Revenue yesterday, you'd be looking at more like a $493 million surplus in fiscal year 23.
Representative Josephson?
Really a comment for the co-chairs. On the subject of the retirement debt, I frankly, even though I'm sort of pretty involved in it because of some of my bills, I don't have a good handle on that issue. So when I first filed in 2011, I was told that this was one of the most urgent matters before the state. And a lot's changed in 10 years, including the $3 billion that we appropriated all at once. But given the returns in the stock market, if we had a 30-minute or 45-minute hearing sort of giving us a sense of what we owe and those sorts of things, it'd be helpful. Thank you.
I will make note of that. Thank you. That's a good thought. I can't help but I guess comment again, you know, every time I look at the surplus or hear that we've got a fairly balanced budget, you know, and then I think about the COVID $375 million and the COVID federal funds that we're using, the one-time funds that we're using to substitute for ongoing annual operating expenses. I just can't help but think that the number is really a deficit of 350, and I guess there is the argument to be made that, you know, the revenue, Department of Revenues got the new number for the revenues, and that certainly helps. I do question, you know, were those updated numbers put in last year's presentation and the year before and the year before? And I guess I'm just looking for consistency. If we're going to use monthly updated numbers, then, you know, let's do that. If we're going to use the fall and spring forecast, then let's do that. And so I just want to throw that out there that, you know, the surplus is, you know, there's a little bit of a caveat for me there to just keep in mind. So any further questions on this slide? Representative Edgman? Representative Merrick?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Steiniger, can you remind me of the amount of SLRF funding you used in this budget?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, the total amount of SLRF funding was about $504 million. We actually have a slide later on in the presentation that breaks down exactly where that went between revenue replacement and direct appropriations.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Edgman?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Dreams come true. They really do. And I don't mean that in the derogatory sense, but the fact that we could have a budget that pays for 50-50 PFD in FY22, which is calendar year 2021, a 50-50 PFD, which pays for, what about $2,500 PFD in calendar year 2022, if I have that correct, oil and gas credits up from $60 million to $199 million, 100% school bond debt reimbursement, $30 million for public safety, some additional expenditures. We don't take a dime out of savings to do it. And I don't think we put a dime back into savings as well with this budget. So I'm going to be looking very closely at peeling back the layers of onions on this budget, because I come from a fishing district, and I'm sure there are some people who take the preseason salmon forecast and start spending money. But we're basically building a budget on money that build it and they will come, with no real contingency factor built into it. I'm concerned about that. I don't view this as a fiscally conservative budget. I view this as a budget that spends money that we don't quite have yet, we haven't earned yet, also spends and changes out normal expenditures that the state would pay for and uses one-time federal funding for it. And then we're promising people we're going to pay them a bigger PFD last year and again this year, and everything's going to work out just perfectly, and then legislators down the road be damned, because you're going to have to pick up the tab for a lot of this stuff that we're paying for today, because we have the good fortune of getting federal money. And Mr. Co-Chairman, I'm going to be keeping a close eye on that, because I'm not one who spends money that I haven't earned yet, and one who budgets beyond my means, and I think that's what this budget does to some extent. Now, I will give the administration credit for putting together, I think, by and large, a status quo budget. I think that's fair. That does its best to meet, you know, the many essential services that we're tasked with providing. But I'm concerned that we're spending money, number one, we don't have, and that this budget promises things that we cannot keep.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. I think you probably more effectively summed up what I was trying to convey, so thank you. Any further questions or comments? Seeing none. Mr. Steiniger, do you have any? Representative Wohl.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to accentuate what Representative Edgman said, there's also things in the FY22 budget that weren't funded that aren't in the supplemental. I'm guessing school bond debt and community assistance, various other things, that oil tax credits that weren't funded in FY22. And I know they're in FY23, but I'm not sure you're going to backfill them in FY22 in your supplemental budget. So I know you're backfilling the PFD to a 50-50 level, but I think there's some other things too that, although they're funded in 23, they weren't funded and still aren't funded for 22.
Mr. Steiniger, I just wanted to say, feel free to rebut anything that I might say. I mean, sometimes I might be incorrect in my thinking on anything, or any of us as well. And so feel free to not have to stick with your PowerPoint presentation. But if you want to jump right in and defend anything, you're more than welcome. I'm a grown adult and won't have my feelings hurt if you say you're wrong. So anyway, yes, please continue, though. And feel free to make any commentaries.
Yes, and thank you, Chair Foster, for the opportunity. What I would like to say, you know, on the assertion of building a budget off of revenues that we haven't earned yet, you know, this budget is built off of the traditional process of using the fall revenue forecast, you know, which is published, you know, every year at the same time, roughly the same time, and is always the document that we use to base our revenue projections at this stage in the process, and gets updated in roughly the March timeframe. So really, this isn't a budget built off of revenues that, you know, that we haven't earned yet, in the sense of that being any different than every year where we need to make, you know, projections of future year revenue to understand, you know, what the capacity for expenditures and what the fiscal outlook is for the state. And, you know, the assertion that, you know, no dime is left to go back into savings, you know, while it's a very small surplus of $26.7 million, which in, you know, a $4.6 billion budget is very small, you know, it is a surplus and a budget that's balanced and puts money back into savings, which is not something that we've, you know, been able to do without making compromises that aren't inherent in this budget this year. So we're able to achieve that without making compromises on things like school bond debt reimbursement or the amount of dividend paid out to the people of Alaska. So I would, you know, take a little bit of contention with the statement that this is, you know, revenue we haven't earned yet. And the federal revenues are, you know, clearly available for unrestricted general fund use by their intention from the federal government. And, you know, just because they are a one-time revenue source do not mean that they're not revenue available for state expenditure and shouldn't be counted in a statement of what the surplus or deficit is for fiscal year 23.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
So if the state loses the higher education lawsuit, that's $400 million out of the CBR. Is that correct? Does that go back in the higher ed fund?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, if that were the outcome of that lawsuit, then yes, the higher ed fund money would not be deposited into the CBR.
If oil prices, God forbid, plummet to $40 this fall, what do we do? And as a policymaker, I have to think about that. I don't think about just putting a budget together where numbers work. And I don't think it's traditional that you take $375 million of federal money and change it out for state money that's going to have to go back in somewhere down the road. I have to disagree with you on that.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman. So on one note, we're not using the money from the higher education fund that went into the CBR in this budget. We're leaving it in the CBR. We're not spending any money out of the CBR. So we're not building the budget on a reliance of that money being transferred in. Additionally, the contention that we wouldn't use the federal money received to the state, you know, I don't necessarily follow that logic. The federal revenues to the state through SLRF, you know, are available for state use to recover from the pandemic. You know, they need to be utilized somehow in the budget. What we're presenting is a way to utilize them to avoid a draw on our savings accounts and to meet the needs of the state's operating budget.
Follow.
Appreciate, Mr. Co-Chair, the opportunity to have a little bit of spirited debate, because we are going to be doing a lot of work together with Mr. Steininger, and I really appreciate your presentations. I think you do a fine job. But I'm concerned as well about contingency measures and about the future, about having money in a savings account that if our entire budget, most of it, which is dependent on you know, global activity, whether it's in the commodities or whether it's oil prices or whatnot, if there's a downturn, where are we going to turn to? You know, that's what I have to look at as a policymaker. And this budget, to me, doesn't really reflect that, because if we lose that higher ed lawsuit, or maybe win it, depending on your perspective, primary savings account is once again down to a very marginal level. And when I look at the budgeting process, and we spent so much time on long-term analysis last year with fiscal plan this and fiscal plan that and looking down the road and what have you, we don't have much in our savings accounts. What happens if the bottom falls out? You know, I guess I have to think about that. And you know, I've yet to see a governor's budget that hasn't had just a little bit of aspiration built into it. This one definitely has that, as every other governor's budget did before it. And I'll stop lecturing here, but I think it's my duty as a member of the Finance Committee to take more than just a short-term look at the budget, and that's what I'm going to do. So thank you for the latitude, Mr. Steininger, and I know you have a different perspective, and we'll be sharing our thoughts as that time goes on.
And I would actually encourage us to take as much time as we want on, I think, kind of this subject. I appreciate the spirited debate. I think this really is the meat of the matter of everything. This is the high-level, big-picture stuff. I mean, the next stage here is we're going to be getting into our subcommittees, and we're going to be talking about, you know, substantive things, but, you know, much smaller things within each department. And I think this big-picture perspective is definitely will help to put things into perspective once we're dealing with the small things in subcommittee. And so I certainly support, you know, any questions that we have. And I think this has spurred on a spirited debate because I've got a little bit of a cue here. I think one person dropped off, but I do want to recognize Representative Thompson also joined us earlier. Thank you. And we've got Representative Rasmussen and Representative Josephson. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I had a couple questions, and I guess before I start, in my mind, if we have federal money that's a one-time use, we can spend it this year, I don't understand why we wouldn't consider that as money available to appropriate in the budget for this fiscal year. If I received a $100 Visa gift card for Christmas, I wouldn't not consider it as something I could spend at the grocery store in January. I would know I don't have it in February. Once I spend it, it's gone. But it doesn't mean that that money doesn't exist. It's there. We should have conversation about it, and we should be considering it and how we're going to spend it in this year's budget. I think Alaskans are still dealing with some of the impacts from the pandemic, and I think that our economy is going to be headed into possibly even tougher times with the interest rates and the housing market going up. I think that's something we should all be considering, that Alaskans may need additional help this year. And if we can provide that to them, I don't see why we wouldn't. So I guess one of the questions I have is, how long do we have to spend the federal COVID money that we have available?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, the SLRF money is available through the end of 2024.
Fiscal year? Sorry, follow up? Is that fiscal year or calendar year?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, it's December 31st, 24.
Thank you. One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Do you know how much money we have right now in the permanent fund, off chance?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I don't actually have that right off the top of my head, you know, north of $80 billion. I don't have the exact number off the top of my head.
One last follow-up.
Follow-up.
So would it be accurate to say that we do, in fact, have a pretty sizable amount of money in a state account?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, yes, there is a considerable amount of money in the permanent fund, which, you know, supports our POMV revenue, which is, you know, what we limited the use of permanent fund to just POMV revenue in this budget, to stick to that, you know, statutory restriction. But yes, there is a considerable amount of money in the permanent fund.
I guess just a follow-up statement, if I could, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I appreciate the opportunity to have this line of questioning. I think that it's disingenuous for us to say that we don't have money available if there were a catastrophic event and oil tanked to $20 a barrel. I don't think that it's responsible for us to use that in an annual event, but I do think that if something bad were to happen, the sky wouldn't fall. We still have options and time, and I believe that we can maneuver and do what's best for Alaskans and fulfill all of the obligations that we have as a government to the public here in Alaska. So I appreciate the governor's budget, and I hope that we will make a good faith effort to actually work with the administration rather than have another political battle this year.
Thank you. I just want to make a real quick, I guess, comment that we've got a little bit of a debate on whether or not you count the one-time COVID money. And one of the analogies that I recently heard, which I kind of liked, and certainly everybody's got their interpretation on this, and I certainly respect that, but what I heard and what I liked was the person said, well, you know, imagine you've got, you know, weekly revenue of $500, and your weekly expenses are $500, and say you've got $200 in your savings account, and say your hours get cut back, and now you're only making $400 per week. And so you've got a deficit of $100 a week in your budget. And you could call that a deficit, but some people would say, well, you could take of your $200 in savings, take $100 and kick that over into your checking account now, and now you've got a balanced budget. But you're going to run out of those, you know, savings. I mean, that amount that came from your savings account was, you know, more of a one-time deal. You can do it twice in this situation, but it's not going to cover your ongoing, you know, expenses, you know, 20 weeks out. And so that was the analogy that I heard and I liked, because, you know, we have to be careful that we don't want to use one-time COVID money to cover ongoing annual operating expenses that, you know, we may be incurring now years out. And so anyway, that's just my two cents. But in the queue, I've got Representative Josephson, and then Representative Johnson, Representative Josephson, and then Representative Ortiz.
Chair, not to be too redundant about on this topic, but Mr. Steininger, in Ways and Means, and we heard presentation, I think, certainly from you and from our fiscal analyst. I noted that at today's sort of projections, we could have draw $4.6 billion in a decade or 9 years. That largely covers the state's expenses today. We'll need more in 9 years. But, you know, even at low oil prices, if we're prudent, we're on a path that is predictable and sustainable. And I guess what I share the concerns of my colleagues from rural Alaska in that while we can go down this approach, you know, there's only one of the 60 of us that knows they're going to be here in January. Undoubtedly, there will be similar faces and some new ones. But, you know, January is not far off. It feels like it is, but I'm getting older, and I know that it's not. So I'm concerned about FY24 and the sustainability of this sort of spending. And part of it is the public's expectations. That's what I'm, you know, this is certainly doable. It's just the public's expectations. And I'm not yet at a point where I think there's no pain to be felt. And granted, they've felt a lot of pain anyway. But do you have any response to that? How do you, and I'm sorry I don't have my 10-year outlook documents with me, give us a sense of how this will play out in FY24 and 25.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, and you know, not having the 10-year plan for everybody in the room and online to look at here, but yes, in fiscal year 24 and for several years in our 10-year outlook, there is a deficit. However, that deficit is, you know, moves towards zero and into a surplus at the end of the 10-year outlook. And what we look at, you know, when we're looking at that outlook and whether or not it is a sustainable plan for Alaska, you know, we're looking at available reserve balances at the end of the day and whether that deficit is able to be managed within those available reserves and whether that deficit, you know, effectively disappears over time. Obviously, a 10-year outlook is, that's a lot of time to look into the future. Yeah, January may not be a long way, but January of 2030 is. And so, you know, there's a lot of assumptions inherent in an outlook like that, and a lot of, you know, presumption of, you know, future policy challenges and decisions that have to be made. So while, you know, on this slide here, I'm showing you a picture of fiscal year 23 with a surplus and, you know, potentially, depending upon how revenue goes, maybe even a larger surplus than is demonstrated here through our use of available revenues, you know, the fiscal problems of the state will, you know, continue, morph, and change. There will always be something we have to address. We know that in building next year's budget, you know, based on our current projections, we'll be facing a, you know, greater than $100 million deficit that, you know, is something that we will be working through and dealing with. You know, there are policy decisions here that were made, you know, things like full reimbursement of school bond debt reimbursement to municipalities. And that's something that we were able to do this year because of revenue. That provides relief to, you know, municipal property taxpayers. In, you know, in a year where there's not available revenues, where we're facing a deficit, we may have to make different decisions. So, yes, in this year, in fiscal year 23, we are able to balance the budget here. And, you know, we think that the decisions that go into it, the things that we are supporting and funding in this budget, are needs of the state and things that we should support because we are able to. And some of them are things we should support regardless of that. You know, public protection is something that, you know, the state has an obligation to support, shouldn't necessarily be revenue constrained. But some of these items are things that are discretionary based on available revenues.
I just want to make a quick comment on something that you said, which I guess going back to Representative Rasmussen, it is real money, no doubt, and we should definitely, you know, count it as such and use it. But I think what I liked, what you said, Representative Josephson, is, you know, is this sustainable? And it's just not sustained revenue. And so, anyway, that's where I keep getting hung up. But we've got Representative Johnson and then Representative Ortiz. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Chair. First of all, I guess it's surprising, I guess good to see just what a difference of opinion or difference of things that I see in the budget. When I saw this come out, I thought it was actually a very well-considered budget. I thought that I have to frankly say that I was impressed because I felt like that the governor or an OMB had worked to listen carefully to those people that had asked for increases that maybe it sometimes hadn't been agreed with in the past and actually been left out of the budget. So I think this budget considers many sides of the political spectrum or requests. And the governor's put forward, I think, something that you should be proud of. And it's a masterful work using a lot of the tools, I think, that you had before you. One of the things that we talk about maybe having these unexpected, well, we talk about having an unexpected breakdown or expenses. We just had an unexpected increase, which I think was good. We also have, I think one thing that was a very conservative way to approach this is not to put the incoming infrastructure package money into this bill. That will be, maybe there's a small pieces of it, but generally that will be considered separately. So that's not included in this. Not every year do we get to put the $4 billion into the transfer into the corpus of the fund, and that's unfortunate. But what we do have is when you have a budget that's balanced this well, it means that you're not taxing too much, you're not taking too much of the people's money, and you're doing a good job with how you think about spending it. So I do too look forward to peeling back the layers and looking at the budget, but and I'm certain there'll be things that I could find that I might say this could be taken out, or I'm certain I'll probably have a few amendments to that effect. But all in all, I think it's a great starting point, and I just want to say I appreciate you bringing that forward. Thanks.
Thank you. We've got Representative Ortiz and then Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going to the topic of the capital budget and under FY23, the total capital budget, $1.67 billion. 1.676, or not 1 point, but 1,676,000,000. So ultimately, we're talking about bonding, am I correct, about 1.5, or is that 1.67 bonded money? Is that what that is?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the 1.67 is both federal money for like surface transportation program or Village Safe Water, the large federal programs in the state. A portion of that, $308 million, is the general obligation bond receipts if the general obligation bond package moves forward, that that we've put forward a revised package this year. So that does go into that. It shows up as other funds in the version of this table that has all the columns.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So as a follow-up on that then, so $300 million plus, roughly a little over $300 million will be bonded then, and so that's incurring debt, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So we could, the administration and legislature could consider, rather than going into further debt in this particular area, we could use some of that one-time money to actually just to do a direct infusion in the capital budget, not incurring debt, and maybe more properly using this one-time money for a one-time expenditure rather than using it to build into the budget and then having the cliff come sometime into the future. Is that a possibility, or is that something that we should consider?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, you know, I understand your logic, but I think in the current interest rate environment, we'd be a little bit remiss not to take the opportunity to take advantage of low interest rates for bonding. You know, that's really what the thought that went into putting forward the general obligation bond package again was, is to try to take advantage of those low interest rates. You know, while it does add debt service to the state, it's, you know, about $22.8 million over the 20-year term. It's, you know, manageable within the debt that we have that's expiring, and, you know, in our 10-year outlook, you know, those, the levels of expenditure that Representative Josephson was asking me about, those do include, you know, the debt service for that. So it fits within our long-term fiscal plan that the administration has put together, and it's just a good opportunity to state.
And Representative Wool, and then Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just so I understand this, FY22, FY23 each have a 50-50 PFD, which is approximately $1.6 billion in the budget. There's a surplus on your chart, but in the fine print, that surplus is up to 400 or so million due to the increase in oil prices recently. So it looks like we have a balanced budget, a 50-50 PFD, and not only balanced, but extra money. And you say, wow, this looks pretty good. But I think what's been pointed out, and just so I understand this, looking ahead to 24, say, or 25, with no more federal COVID money coming in, and just having to pay for it with state revenue, and oil, say, is closer to $70, which I think is what the projection is by DNR revenue, that we would be looking at a deficit in a normal year without federal money, and say oil was slightly down to what it's projected to be with a 50-50 PFD and a relatively flat budget, we would be looking at a deficit going forward for a few years. And I believe that's what you presented the other day in Ways and Means. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes. The 10-year plan is based off of the, you know, December 15th fall revenue sources book, and so it doesn't reflect the updates from yesterday from the Department of Revenue, so it is a much more conservative revenue forecast as well, but it does have a deficit in the, you know, next several fiscal years, but that deficit gets closed over time.
Thank you.
Okay, and we've got Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I believe in one of the meetings I had, possibly with revenue, I apologize, I can't for certain remember what group it was that I met with, but it was my understanding that we couldn't use the federal money for infrastructure and some of capital expenses, we would not be able to use that money. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, there are a couple of stipulations on the SLRF money, the main one being no use to pay directly pay debt service. I'm not aware of any restrictions on capital expenditures. We do have some direct use of the SLRF money in our capital budget. But I will also add that the pot of money, the SLRF pot of money, is one of many, many, many different pots of money that came from ARPA and CARES and all the different federal relief bills that have come over the last several years. So just not knowing the conversation, it may have been another pot of federal relief money that's significantly more restricted. Most were more restricted than SLRF.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Edgman.
So I recognize my earlier comments were a little bit combative, perhaps, but I want to be very clear, and I don't deal with my own finances this way either. I want to look for every opportunity we can to put money into savings, some money. And I know there's some in this room and some outside this room that would spend every single dime, and then more some if they could, which has been the role of the legislature for how many years now? But I want to be very clear, if we have the opportunity to put money away for that rainy day, which is going to come, well, revenue goes up, stock market goes down, we need to have a contingency factor built in the budget, and if I need to, I'll run an amendment here on the table, we'll consider it at that time. Thank you.
Thank you. I forget how that old saying goes. Maybe somebody can help me, but you know, we want to put money away because otherwise we find ourselves in that situation with that bumper sticker that says, oh, please just give me one more oil boom or one more, you know, crisis COVID or whatever, federal money coming in for COVID. Or anyway, I agree with you, Representative Edgman, I think is what I'm trying to say. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I am pleased to hear that I am in agreement with the representative from the western part of Alaska. I think that if we can work together and find our way to find even a better way to slim down the budget, find the things that need to be fixed, find some efficiencies, I'm all for it. And so, again, I think it's a great starting point. I appreciate that. And also think that there's always work to be done, and I look forward to getting the work on it. Thanks.
Okay. With that, unless you've got any comments on any of the comments that have been made, we can continue with your PowerPoint, Mr. Steiniger.
Okay. Moving to slide six. Slide six is on the savings balances available to the state. So the state has two primary savings balances or savings accounts, the statutory budget reserve and the constitutional budget reserve. The statutory budget reserve has about $70 million in it left after the direct appropriations made in fiscal year 22. So, you know, to answer the question of what money is available, should there be, you know, a need, you know, this $70 million is available, you know, through a simple majority appropriation. The constitutional budget reserve, you know, is only available with a supermajority or a three-quarter vote appropriation, but that balance will grow over the FY 22 to 23 period. The beginning balance there of $1.17 billion, one thing to note about that is it's based on pre-audited financial information. The reason for that, you know, traditionally, you know, we try to use a, you know, audited financial statement and extend it forward. And this year, because of the sweep, you know, the only information we had available to estimate the amounts swept into the constitutional budget reserve is pre-audit. So we had to use pre-audit information for that account balance. And that represents about $490 million being swept into the CBR under Article 9, Section 17D. So this number, I will say, will be updated once financial statements are audited. So do expect to see some change in that balance. In our FY23 budget, I mentioned this real briefly earlier, what we've done is try to build a budget that doesn't rely upon those balances to meet the needs of state programs. So trying to ensure that those state programs are, you know, not subject to uncertainty over, you know, a robust debate over the structure of state finances and accounts, and make sure that those programs, you know, regardless of that debate, can continue and operate. So you'll see about $34 million in fund change actions within state agency budgets to shift from designated general funds that were swept into unrestricted general fund appropriations to ensure that, you know, fiscal year 23 revenue is, you know, all that's required to support those programs, and they're not reliant on previous balances.
Representative LeBon and then Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are state savings accounts described as the statutory budget reserve and the constitutional budget reserve? To access those accounts, one takes a simple majority, that's the SBR. The CBR takes a supermajority, three-quarter vote. Could you maybe summarize for the listening audience how money flows into both accounts and what sources they are?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, the statutory budget reserve, the money in that account was directly appropriated to that account by the legislature. There's no, you know, automatic flow of revenues into that account. It's kind of ad hoc savings made by the legislature. So about 481, or exactly 481 million, was deposited in, 410 appropriated out, and that leaves that residual amount. The constitutional budget reserve, there's constitutional provisions of certain types of revenues, you know, settlements in certain types of cases, things of that nature that flow into the constitutional budget reserve. You can see these earnings and deposits projected. That's the difference in that nomenclature between deposits and earnings and deposits, because there's really, you know, automatic deposits that go into the CBR of about $30 million and $60 million in the 2 years.
And if I could follow up, Mr. Chairman, so talking about the CBR, that balance that's now in the CBR, does that include all the designated accounts that were swept, and is the biggest dollar amount in there the higher education fund?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, yes, that includes the $490 million that was swept, or estimated that was swept, because that's the pre-audit number, and about $400 million of that came from the Higher Education Investment Fund.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Josephson?
Yes, thank you, through the chair, Mr. Steininger. The 33.6, there are scores of sub-budgets or sub-funds that were swept as designated funds, and most of them fall under that 33.6. They're small enough so that I think there's like 100 of them, that when you add them together, setting aside the higher education fund, and PCE has been resolved, more or less, it's only 33.6 million?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the 33.6 is just the difference between anticipated revenue into those funds in 23 and the appropriation need for the program. So just to kind of put in an example, you may have the, let's take the alcohol taxes. You know, they go into an account that supports mental health programs. You know, they're projecting, and they'll project maybe, you know, say, $10 million in revenue. That's not the actual number, but, and then we have $12 million in programs needed. We would have done a $2 million fund change to accommodate the difference between projected revenue and expenditure need. So the utilization of those designated funds is much greater than the $33 million. It's just the $33 million is what's needed to protect the programs effectively.
Follow up?
Can you, to the chair, can you tell us, other than the two that come to mind are the SPAR fund? I've gotten some communications of real concern about that. And of course, the higher education fund, I think it's sort of inarguable that there's a constituency that is sort of panicked about that, or at least concerned. are there others? Because I'm not hearing from the boiler or the elevator inspection fund folks. Are there any other groups that you know of that are alarmed by having their funds swept?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this transition to kind of a post-sweep structure of the budget is going to take some time to kind of figure out all the implications. What you see here is, you know, kind of the initial attempt to ensure that the programs can function. But as we move forward, looking at some of these programs, the reason that there's a special fund for the program is because those revenues are slightly volatile. You know, you may collect $7 million 1 year for the next, back and forth. And so this fund change is based on what we're projecting for next year. And if, you know, there's not a smoothing account for that program, you may need variable fund changes year over year, or just kind of taking a new look at how we finance a given program. And so there is necessary work over time to kind of make this transition to a sort of post-sweep support of these programs and just look at the structure of, you know, fund sources of some of the programs. But most of them are, you know, smaller in dollar. That's why it adds up to 33.6, because a lot of them are a couple hundred thousand dollar fund change needed, because the revenue volatility is only in the couple hundred thousand dollar level.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Out of curiosity, over the last couple of years with COVID, we've received a lot of federal money for COVID mitigation and for SPAR money you're speaking of. What are the balances of unspent money in those grants that we were eligible for and received? What do we have money left that hasn't been spent?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the big one would be the $504 million in SLRF money we're using here in this budget. For others, I think I'd actually want to get back to you in writing with a list of those programs and the expenditures, just because I don't think I can quote them off the top of my head.
Okay, please proceed.
So briefly on the capital budget, and I know we'll have a subsequent presentation to go into a lot more detail. As I mentioned earlier, the fiscal year 23 capital budget is really a baseline traditional capital budget, sort of the minimum level of capital budget necessary for federal match and core state functions. That adds up to $157.4 million in UGF and about $1.4 billion in federal revenues for things like the Surface Transportation Program or Village Safe Water. But looking at how to achieve the over an investment in capital larger than just that bare minimum, we looked at revenue surpluses in fiscal year 22 that we could utilize to make capital investments. There's about $93 million in supplemental capital appropriations, really looking at projects that will benefit from expedited construction or the ability to get contractors on contract earlier. One thing that we know is with coming infrastructure money that's going, you know, throughout the nation, Alaska is going to be competing with 49 other states for construction jobs. And so we think it's prudent to try to get some of these, you know, state projects started sooner through the supplemental budget in order to get some of those contractors online and get commitments to, you know, keep people in Alaska while we're waiting for the infrastructure money to roll in. Similarly, we're using general obligation bond financing for community projects. I think I quote $308 million earlier. It's $325 in bond issuance. And, you know, this will, you know, require a vote of Alaskans to, you know, authorize the issuance of debt for the purpose of capital infrastructure. But we looked at this as a way to, you know, invest in key community projects and infrastructure around the state as kind of a next stage after those supplemental capital projects, because geobond projects take a little bit longer because they do require that vote of the people. So it's sort of, you know, you can think of this in stages, early projects in the supplemental bill, midterm projects in the general obligation bill, and then the infrastructure money to come over time in the future.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I saw a geo bond package that said 308. Is the 325 an updated number?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, yes, this 325 represents the draft of the geo bond issuance bill. There's one project that needs to be added in the budget amendment that is the difference between the 308 and the 325.
Thank you very much.
Please continue.
So slide 8 is the swoop graph, which we generally include just to show the kind of relative sizes of agency budgets. You know, this year there's actually a little bit of change and difference here, as one of our proposals is to split the Department of Health and Social Services into the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. So you can see that reflected here in the slide by the somewhat smaller line for the Department of Health and Health and Social Services used to occupy. And the other thing to note here, I mentioned the significant savings in the state's retirement payments. The retirement bar here used to be the force column on this slide and now is down, you know, near number 10. So that's been a significant savings. That's kind of shifted this slide around. So moving on, looking at agency operating budget changes. So this table kind of categorizes the main categories of change in agency operating budgets for fiscal year 23. You know, first we have about $108 million in building cost drivers and increases to the budget. You know, we have some places where there was one-time federal relief used in the DOT budget last year that had to be backed out. We have an increase in the Medicaid budget of $45 million. Some changes to rates charged across agencies, that's added $4 million to the budget. Salary adjustments, the previously mentioned impacts of the sweep, and just a whole suite of other very small adjustments that add up to about $1 million. These are kind of the baseline adjustments we knew we need to make. I'll cover a little bit more about the Medicaid increase later, but for the most part, these are a sort of starting point of putting our budget together. We then have about $136 million in agency reductions, the largest of which is the use of federal monies to support the Alaska Marine Highway System. There's a five-year rural ferry program in the infrastructure bill. That's a one exception to the, you know, decision not to show any of the infrastructure funding in this budget in December, because that program can be supported through that language entirely with federal money and a very small amount of state money. We felt it prudent to show that in the budget. There's also a small reduction in the K-12 formula. I have a little bit more information on that in a later slide. Significant reductions from PERS, TERS, and Senate Bill 55 that was enacted last year, which just changed the way that we finance our retirement system obligations. Targeted savings of about $12 million. And then targeted investments in, you know, public safety, public protection, resource development, and primacy over resources. And that's what adds up to that net change of a roughly flat but slightly up budget of $13.9 million change from 22. And I have more detail in later slides on all of these items.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The $63 million for the ferries, federal money infrastructure bill, that's displacing state money. As we know, is that 1 year or is that 5 years that we get that $60 million?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, it's a five-year program written into the infrastructure bill, $200 million nationwide for rural ferry programs, of which only two ferry programs in the country qualify. The state unrestricted general fund was $63.4 million. That's what was offset. It also offsets use of Alaska Marine Highway System funds, so the receipts for riding the ferry. There is a little bit still needed in the budget to cover costs that aren't federally allowable. you know, just some kind of ancillary costs in running the ferry system. But it effectively removes all but $5 million of state money from ferry system operations.
Follow up? Yeah, so it's just 1 year, this FY23. FY24, if we want to keep the ferries at the same level, we will have to have $60 million of our own money, non-federally subsidized. Or would that infrastructure, the $200 million, keep kicking in?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, it's a five-year program in the infrastructure bill, so this will continue for 5 years. And then that after that 5 years, all of the programs in the infrastructure bill, like the surface transportation program, are authorized in five-year chunks. So, you know, there is still, in 5 years, there may be the opportunity for the federal government to reinstate the rural system, the rural ferry system program. But what we do know now is that the next 5 years, we will have the opportunity to claim this money. So it's not just 1 year.
Oh, sorry for staying on this one. So it's 60 million times five, 300 million. So that number will stay constant over the next 5 years from the federal government? Or is it 60 this year and then the program's 5 years, and how much goes in the next four?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, as we understand the bill right now, it's 200 million a year for 5 years for the rural ferry system program. And they're federal fiscal years, not state, so it'll, you know, change a little bit. And that's nationwide, yes.
With two states.
With two states competing.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So looking at formula cost drivers, for those unfamiliar, formula cost drivers are, you know, state programs where the amount of expenditure necessary is based on, you know, inputs of eligible individuals or, you know, some other mathematical formula that results in a, you know, a state obligation. In K-12 education, we've fully funded that obligation to the $5,930 base student allocation. There are some shifts between the fiscal year 22 amount for education and 23, resulting in a $19 million reduction. Here you'll see it's a small reduction in the regular ADM or brick and mortar students, and an increase in correspondence students. For a very small overall reduction in ADM, in average daily membership. That reduction then translates to the $19 million reduction in state obligation, primarily because correspondence students receive a little bit less funding from the state than brick and mortar in acknowledgement of, you know, the different costs of providing that education. On the Medicaid program, we are currently benefiting from an enhanced federal match rate, or FMAP, that is a result of the COVID disaster declaration at the federal level. That declaration was very recently extended through the end of this state fiscal year. We built our FY23 budget on the assumption that that declaration will expire on June 30th. And so we had to add $45 million in unrestricted general fund to restore the state share portion required to cover that program. We also have built into that $45 million a couple of, you know, reform initiatives to look at the program and ensure that, you know, the number of eligible Medicaid beneficiaries is accurate. During the pandemic, we've reached the point where over a third of Alaskans are on Medicaid. As we move out of that economic hardship, you know, our hope is that, you know, we can transition people into, you know, other sources of getting their health care needs.
Yeah, Representative Lebon and then Josephson. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I would like to go back to slide 9, and I'm going to follow up with Representative Wool's questions about the marine highway system and using federal monies for that system. We're using it for operating costs. Is there any sidebars on that money? For example, could we use some or all of it for a capital maintenance fund for the system and use state operating dollars to operate the system and build up a fund for maintenance and helping build the system back up, because it's taken some budget hits in recent years?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, there's the federal monies that we're using in the fiscal year 23 operating budget are just the rural ferry program in the infrastructure bill. There's actually a couple of other items in the infrastructure bill that address ferry systems that we haven't accommodated yet in the budget because we just don't necessarily fully know the rules behind them. You know, it's taking time to get guidance on some of the infrastructure bill programs. But some of those do cover things like construction of new boats, shoreside facilities, things of that nature that we're just trying to, you know, trying to get to the point of understanding to know how to best deploy them. So we know there will be other opportunities for federal funding that can help with ferry system transition. One of the important things here with all this federal money coming in for the ferry system is, you know, ensuring that if it is something that only lasts 5 years, that we spend that 5 years transitioning the ferry system to something that is sustainable when it has to come back onto full state support. And so I think it's important to make sure we're, you know, properly using those different federal revenues that will become available to best, you know, best support that system and make some of the changes to, you know, some of the needs that, that you're highlighting.
Gotcha. Thank you. And I guess just a follow-up comment. It would seem worth investigating to see, I can't recall what our capital maintenance fund is for the Marine Highway System, how big that is, or is it underfunded? Is it adequately funded? I mean, I would think this is an opportunity to shore up that funding pool for maintaining the system going forward and maybe not put all that federal subsidy money into operations, but maybe there's a shared approach to that funding and some capital and some operating. So that would just be a general comment. Thank you.
And through the chair, Representative Lebon, if I may, you know, one of the other benefits here to using the federal funding is we'll still be collecting those receipts when people ride the ferry, but we'll not need to spend them for the operations of the system because we have the federal money available. And so that, you know, $50 to $60 million in revenue annually, you know, will be able to be used for other things or saved up for, you know, money that can be used for the ferry system at a later date.
Is this a comment on a quick, got a queue here.
Yeah.
Representative Wolf.
Well, my understanding, the ferry replacement fund, which I think was about $27 million, which maybe Representative LeBron was referring to, that's been swept, right? And it's in the CBR, so that's no longer available to the ferries?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes, the ferry replacement fund, or the vessel replacement fund, is a fund subject to the sweep.
Representative Josephson, then Representative Edgeman, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson.
Yes, just super fast, if I might, through the chair, Mr. Steininger. If we updated the BSA to reflect about 5 years of inflation, what would any back of the napkin idea of what that would cost?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't want to do just kind of mental mass ad hoc. But I could get back to you in writing.
I'd like that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Edgeman.
Back on page 9, Mr. Co-Chair, I think it's just only fitting to thank our congressional delegation for their work in getting a lot of this money to Alaska. I think I would stand to be corrected in the over $1 trillion federal infrastructure bill, not a lot went into operations. Mind you, this is largely a capital budget bill back east, but thanks to Senator Murkowski and the rest of the delegation, we were able to get money steered towards the operations of the Marine Highway System. And Mr. Steininger, please correct me if I'm off base here, but I don't think I'm off base when I say that the Marine Highway System is a critical part of the transportation chain in all of Alaska, and this is money that's badly needed. I won't get on my soapbox about the Tustamina and the replacement of other ferries, but we'll talk about that later, too. Thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I agree with my colleague from Western Alaska that I applaud our federal delegation and Senator Murkowski's leadership on many efforts this year, one of them being the Marine Highway. And I was just curious, have we increased ferry service in this budget?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, yes, we have, and thank you for that question. So the benefit is not just saving the $63.4 million in unrestricted general fund and the, you know, the corresponding amount in Marine Highway System receipts, but also this program allows us to run, you know, kind of run a maximized schedule. So in prior years, we would keep boats tied up on the docks just for the purpose of saving money. This allows us to run, you know, effectively all the boats with one in reserve in case of breakdowns, but to run a more maximized schedule and increase the level of service that would be experienced in coastal communities.
Okay. Thank you, and please continue with your presentation.
So I already covered slide 10, but I'm going to pause here if there are any other questions.
I don't see any.
So slide 11, highlighting some of the investments in public protection, you know, kind of throughout the spectrum of public protection agencies, public safety, Department of Law, corrections, public defenders. So we've added money for fully filled positions in public safety and law. There are some positions added in prior budgets that were only partially funded. In acknowledgement of time needed to fill those positions, they've been filled, and so there's a necessity to fund them. We added 15 new trooper position seats so that the Department of Public Safety can continue to maximize recruitment efforts. Also adding 10 new seats for village public safety officers and related costs, including both, you know, the pay for those VPSOs as well as, you know, support costs. There's also an increase in the salaries for existing VPSOs to try and encourage, you know, better recruitment and retention of those positions. We haven't just focused on that direct law enforcement, but we also have a lot of support systems in the Department of Public Safety, 14 new support positions, and that's really to allow those troopers to focus on policing and not doing, you know, other non-policing work. We've added positions for rural fire investigations, as well as increasing DNR wildland firefighting capacity, and that's about $4.5 million. There's a lot of institutional support positions, 30 new PCNs in the Department of Corrections. This includes both a new booking unit in the Highland Mountain facility, mental health treatment units, and just general support positions throughout the institutions, adding up to $4.1 million. We also have an initiative to try to address the trial backlogs that have built up over the course of the pandemic. That's $1.8 million and a little less than $500,000 for defense capacity.
Got a question from Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to focus a little bit on those 15 new trooper positions. Where will they be sent?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, those 15 new trooper positions primarily are in the Mat-Su Valley. The department does like to recruit into more of the urban areas and send senior troopers out into rural areas. But the new positions are predominantly in the Mat-Su Valley.
So follow up, is Mat-Su experiencing a crime wave that they need 15 additional troopers?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, I think I would defer that question to the Department of Public Safety.
Yeah, I guess that wasn't an appropriate question. I guess my real question is, why not Fairbanks? And if it's to enhance rural public safety, and my understanding was these trooper positions, some of them would be viewed as mobile, rapid response, could head out to rural communities as needed. Is that part of the vision for these 15 additional trooper positions?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, these 15 positions, you know, we're really trying to enable the department to recruit as aggressively as possible to address a lot of their, you know, their vacancies of troopers and their retention issues. I think for a more comprehensive view of the strategy of deployment of troopers throughout the state and regionality, I would defer to the Department of Public Safety. They could give you a much better idea of that, the logistics of
and,
that.
And I realize, thank you for that answer, Mr. Chairman. I realize we're going to get deeper into the troopers' budget and subcommittees and the full House Finance Committee. I know the department has struggled to just keep up with the churn in the trooper positions, and in the last two budget cycles, we've seen vacancies and new trooper hires roughly equal out, and we're still chasing our tail, if you will, with adding troopers. And I don't know if that condition has changed. I guess we'll find out when the subcommittee meets for the public safety budget. But I'm hoping that we're making progress on just keeping up with retirements and troopers leaving, and that it's a bold goal to add an additional 15 positions on top of keeping up with the retirements and the churns, and at least that's what I'm recalling from our last couple budget cycles. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Merrick.
Thank you. I would just like to respond to that. I did have a meeting this morning with the Department of Public Safety, and I think you'll be satisfied with some of the explanations that they gave to me and similar to questions that you're having. So we will definitely take that up in subcommittee.
Okay. And I see no further questions. Mr. Steininger?
So continuing with some more of the public protection investments in the fiscal year 23 budget, we have what's called the People First Initiative. This is centered around domestic violence, sexual assault, missing and murdered indigenous persons, homelessness, as well as foster care and the Office of Children's Services. So really trying to look at a kind of holistic human side of public protection. So this includes $3.5 million for victim services grants, $1.5 million to reduce the turnaround time on DNA testing and increase lab capacity, $1 million for victim services and perpetrator intervention, tribal liaisons and support for missing persons clearinghouses. So this is, you know, tracking missing persons, a coordinator for statewide homelessness to look at this across departments, as well as a database and a data manager to kind of track these issues and get better data on what's going on for, you know, future, more informed future interventions. And we also have $1.4 million for the Tribal Child Welfare Compact in the Office of Children's Services.
Representative Edgman?
Yes, where will the tribal liaisons be located? It's my rough understanding that at least one of those positions, if not more, will be in the governor's office directly. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I'll have to get back to you on exactly where all of those positions are located, but we're trying to have, you know, more tribal liaison engagement with, you know, agencies and the governor's office to ensure that, you know, there's lines of communication there for all the functional areas that impact, you know, some of these needs that we see in the state.
I would like to take an opportunity just to thank the administration for trying to spread some of the services that are being added to. They're both in urban as well as I'm seeing some rural things here as well, which whether it's the VPSOs, the Tribal Compact, the Tribal Liaison, Missing and Murdered, and so forth. And so those are good to see. So I just wanted to say those are positive things that I'm happy to see. So thank you.
So moving to slide 13 on resource development and state primacy. So we've made investments in the fiscal year 23 budget to try to encourage both, you know, development of resources as well as, you know, remove some of the, you know, kind of red tape from, you know, permitting processes. So that includes expanding timber resource capacity in the Department of Natural Resources with a statewide timber program, and assuming primacy within the Department of Environmental Conservation from the EPA over resource development permitting, both from the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, that's solid waste type permitting, and the Clean Water Act Section 404, which is, you know, for discharge into waterways and things of that nature. We also have another $4 million to continue our effort on statehood defense, and continue to, you know, advocate for Alaska's needs in resource development and ensure that, you know, there's an Alaska voice in decisions being made on these issues. Over in the capital budget, we do have funding for development of mariculture and agriculture industries, and that's really to, you know, build industry in the state and enhance food security and economic development. Between the two, that's $50 million in the capital budget.
Okay, and Representative Ortiz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steiniger, going to your, back to your Clean Water Act section, $4.9 million increment. How does that match with, I mean, last year, DEC, we attempted to encourage them at the subcommittee level to hire for unfilled positions in SPAR, spill response and recovery. They didn't do that. Yet now they're, the same department is asking for $4.9 million of an increment to, in essence, create a new section of DEC. Is that what we're doing here?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, effectively here this would be creating a new section, a new activity under state government, but we see this as, you know, a benefit. Currently, this work is being done at the federal level, you know, outside of Alaska, and so while this does, yes, represent a significant addition to the, you know, the number of people at DEC and the work being done by DEC, we see that addition as something that will benefit Alaska in the long term, by bringing kind of more of a state focus to the decisions being made.
And do we see this as a 1 year increment, or do we see this as an ongoing expense for DEC, 4.9 per year to do this activity?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, this is the first year, but this would be a new permanent activity done by DEC. And so this would, you know, scale up over time as they built the capacity.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
And we also have a number of areas in the fiscal year 23 budget aimed at improving the function of state government. So there's an executive order to split the Department of Health and Social Services into the Department of Family and Community Services and the Department of Health. This will really help bring additional leadership focus to the functional areas under the two new departments. There is a bit of a cost, $434,000 in unrestricted general fund, about $2 million total for the new positions. Just as you add a new department, you need a new commissioner, a new finance officer, things of that nature. Within the Department of Public Safety, we've transferred in the public safety communication system. So that was previously at the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. However, the function of that system is, you know, best aligned with some mission of DPS. They also have an existing division that the system fits better into than it did within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs structure. So we think that it can be, you know, managed a little bit, you know, more efficiently there just based on other work they're already doing. We're transferring the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council from the Department of Fish and Game to the Department of Environmental Conservation. This is in acknowledgement the Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner is the, you know, chair of that trustee council. In the Department of Administration, we have a lot of investments in information technology related to kind of pandemic proofing and making safer the state's IT infrastructure. There's just shy of $29 million in UGF capital investments. The idea is to try to pandemic proof and then also, you know, get the state better situated for the next major cyber attack. For those who have been following, you know, the Department of Health and Social Services suffered under a cyber attack, which has caused, you know, a lot of disruption in their services. And, you know, we think it's prudent to make an investment now to, you know, prevent that into the future. Another thing that's a little more in the, you know, technical weeds of budget development, we've restructured how we reflect changes in department administration budget transactions to better show the cost to other agencies. So when you're in your subcommittees looking at your other agency budgets, you'll see a lot of transactions related to changes in the department administration, and that's just to reflect, you know, how they'll pay for the bill from DOA for increases in IT costs.
Mr. Chairman, real quick.
Representative LeBond.
Thank you. A couple years ago, we moved the communication system to the Military and Veterans Affairs. Is this just reversing that action, and why is that action being reversed?
Through the chair, Representative LeBond, it was moved from Department of Administration to Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and now it's being moved to the Department of Public Safety. So in the system really didn't fit within the Department of Administration, and so a move was necessary. And in the transition to DMVA, you know, it became pretty clear that it better fit in Department of Public Safety. And so, you know, DMVA did all the good work to work out the kinks of the transition in the first place, and now it should very smoothly go over to the Department of Public Safety.
So thank you. If I one follow up, so I guess we learned that maybe that wasn't the right move. It needed to go to Department of Public Safety, so we're just correcting that.
Through the chair, Representative LeBond, that's
sounds
correct.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Wu?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just on the previous page, I just really quickly, the $50 million for agriculture, for food security, which is a great cause and a great idea. Is there any talk of how that $50 million is to be spent? And someone just mentioned to me that a citizen mentioned the need for to freeze or blanch and freeze Alaskan-grown foods, and that's a much-needed thing for food security. And I don't know, where does $50 million go for food security?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, so there's $25 million in mariculture and $25 million in ag, so kind of two separate programs. The mariculture program being more grant-focused with, you know, a lot more detail that we can provide working with Department of Commerce. The Division of Agriculture will be managing the agriculture side of this. And, you know, it's $50 million across a handful of different you know, tasks and objectives. And so I think maybe I could get back to you with some more information from the department, or they could provide a presentation on it to the subcommittee.
Yeah. Please continue.
So a little bit on use of federal COVID relief funding in the operating budget and capital budget. So the American Rescue Plan Act discretionary funding, this is the SLRF funding that was discussed considerably earlier. We have $375 million used for revenue replacement. And then we have several direct appropriations of that money. $20 million in the fast track supplemental budget for public health response. So there was $20 million appropriated to the Department of Health and Social Services for 22 already. And that money at the time, you know, was appropriated for what was estimated to be about 6 months of need. And so we see the need for a little bit more as we have other variants and just continued public health response. There's also several operating investments, $10 million for workforce development in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, $22.8 million in the University of Alaska for economic development, targeted economic development initiatives, including drone research, critical mineral research and heavy oil recovery research. There's $3.5 million for domestic violence and sexual assault victim services. Individuals last year may remember there was an issue with the federal VOCA funding, which we utilized American Rescue Plan Act money to cover in fiscal year 22. That's required again in 23. There is a pending fix at the federal level, so this shouldn't be a continuing need for the state. This should get us through to the federal fix. And then there's $1.1 million continuation from last year of DNA collection activities in the Department of Corrections. There's also $72 million in capital projects in direct appropriations from the SLRF funding. And then the Coronavirus Capital Project Fund. This was a fund with about $112 million to the state of Alaska with a variety of stipulations on what it can be used for. In our capital budget, we've allocated $64 million of it, but there remains about $48 million left to be allocated for projects that meet those criteria.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and then through the chair. So on that $64 million that was already appropriated, would you just go through some examples of what that would have been for?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the $64 million hasn't actually been appropriated. It's allocated in our proposed capital budget. So there are three projects. There is a student IT system for the University of Alaska. So that helps with, you know, distance learning for students as well as, you know, needs that the university was experiencing. There is a money for a the fire facility in Eagle River that will be built as a, you know, kind of community center concept to meet the Coronavirus Capital Project Fund requirements. And then the third project, I'm sorry, drawing a blank on the third project. It may come to me in a second.
Representative, follow up. Representative Ortiz, or we might have a lifeline.
Nope.
Okay, Representative Ortiz.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steinigan, about the $72 million in capital projects, I'm sure I missed it. Is there a list of what those projects are to make up that $72 million of spending?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, and I believe we'll be coming back with a more robust capital presentation where I'll have a little more of the details on those for you. Yes.
Okay, please continue.
So we covered a little bit earlier statewide operating items. This table gives a bit more detail on those. So debt service this year is up by about $60 million. That really is just the reinstatement of the school bond debt reimbursement, adding $60 million of UGF to the operating budget. And I'll note, just to answer Representative Johnson's earlier question, health information systems in the Department of Health and Social Services, so to create better access to distance medical records, was the other Coronavirus Capital Project Fund project. Thank you. Also within, so back to statewide operations, we have a significant reduction in retirement assistance payments that we've covered. That's $116 million in the statewide items. Under fund capitalizations and transfers, that's where we see a significant increase in the oil and gas tax credits. The fiscal year 22 amount was not the full statutory appropriation, but in 23, the full statutory appropriation is being proposed. A reduction stated on the slide of the disaster relief fund. However, that $34 million is part of our supplemental proposal. That's a deposit into the disaster relief fund for continued work, primarily continued work on the earthquake disaster from several years ago. We have an increase in the REAA fund, and that goes hand in hand with school bond debt reimbursement and is fully funded at the statutory level. And a reduction in other. That reduction in other, I'll note, is not actually a reduction in the transfers being made, but just a recategorization In discussion between OMB and Ledge Finance, there's statutory designation of specific revenues that go to a certain fund that previously were recorded as unrestricted general fund and have shifted to DGF fund reports. So I think I've covered most of the points on this slide already, but just to reiterate, the savings in the retirement system are primarily strong investment performance, as well as the avoidance of overcontribution to the health trusts. There's also the Senate Bill 55 that was enacted last year that allowed us to finance our payments for retirement system obligations, and there's been continued shift to other fund sources, saving $14.7 million in unrestricted general fund in addition to the amount saved in the fiscal year 22 budget.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steiniger, on the $161.1 million in savings for reduction in contributions to the retirement, Representative Joseph spoke a little bit about this issue earlier, and I understand we're going to meet on that at a later time with more specificity, but is it a broad, correct overview that we used to have concerned about unfunded liability, and now we don't have any unfunded liability to the retirement system?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there's still unfunded liability. The funded ratio is less than 100%, and that's why we still have an obligation above the normal cost to pay into the retirement system. But because of the strong investment returns that we've had, that obligation has gone down considerably because we've been closing the gap on the liability and the amount of assets available. And I know that DRB and the Armed Board could speak much more eloquently to those issues than I can.
Please continue.
Other statewide items, as I said, we're fully funding the school bond debt reimbursement, and that's a total of $79 million. Similarly, the rural school construction contributions or the regional education attendance area fund of $32.8 million UGF. We've made a full deposit to the community assistance fund. Like other funds, power cost equalization had very strong investment returns that allow for the entire PCE waterfall, as it's called, where all the different statutory designations of that fund to be fully funded. And we have full funding for oil and gas tax credits at $199 million. And just briefly on the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, as has been noted, there's very minimal use of any money from the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act in the budget that was put forward on December 15th. Really just utilization of the money for the Alaska Marine Highway Systems through the Rural Ferries Program. The reason for that, similar to a year ago when we were talking about ARPA, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty and unknowns right now in this program. You know, there's some areas where initial takes immediately after the bill was passed thought we might receive very large amounts of money for new programs that have kind of shaken out in later information that we've received. So the details are still actively changing as we're analyzing the bill, and the information coming out of the federal agencies, you know, we don't have guidance from all of them on all of these programs yet. So as we get that information, you know, expect to hear more about what the, you know, state budget requirements might be for some of those programs as we learn more about them.
Thank you, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I know the answer to this, but going back to the school bond indebtedness, that's just the state's promise to help pay local community school bond debt. It's not beyond that state promise, be it 70% or in some cases 50%.
Yes, through the chair, Representative LeBon, depending upon the year that a municipality entered into the debt, the state's share per statute is different, 70, 80, 50%, depending upon the year. The $79 million represents the statutory obligation under that program.
Thank you. Representative Edgeman, and then Wool, and then Thompson.
Yeah, back to the final page, final slide 19. What's the expectation, or what would we, what should we expect on the federal infrastructure money coming forward? Sort of a two-tiered question. One is, does OMB plan to submit the amendments as more information comes forth, number one? And number two, there's got to be a lot of behind-the-scenes planning going through the Department of Transportation, where a bulk of this money is going to reside. But what can we expect here at the committee in terms of between now and the end of session on all this?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, yes, I would say expect as we get more guidance on these programs and as we know more, that there will be budget amendments necessary for some of them, not all, but some of them certainly. The analysis being done now is really looking at, you know, what in this bill comes to the state of Alaska as a state, what comes into the state of Alaska as, you know, the government institution, what departments it's going to, is it, you know, supplementing an existing program or an entirely new program where we need to do a lot of legwork at the department end to qualify or to receive the money. So we're still in that stage of understanding. Some of them I think will come to understanding definitely within session and the ability to bring in a budget amendment to address, you know, changes in the program. You know, at this stage we don't have, you know, any that we're ready to release a budget amendment to the legislature just because we're not at that stage of understanding. But yes, definitely do expect to see, you know, more information coming out of particularly those departments most impacted. You know, Department of Transportation, Department of Environmental Conservation, you know, departments where there's, you know, significant amounts coming through.
Yeah. Is it the administration's intent to work with the legislature and go through the appropriations process, or are we to just be in wait-and-see mode and expect that some of this may go through the RPL process of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, you know, we're definitely here to work with the legislature. We'd be happy to come in and give a more robust presentation on what we do know about, you know, the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and, you know, provide kind of what our current understanding is and, you know, work with you on budget amendments going forward. A lot of these programs are, you know, slight tweaks to existing programs. This isn't, you know, the same discretionary funding that we had through ARPA or CARES. You know, it's really not a COVID-related relief bill, so it doesn't have that same sort of, you know, emergency response nature to it. So, yeah, it's a lot more of just existing programs, but then a lot of, you know, new programs as well. But much more guidance required from the federal government, much less open-ended funding than we've talked about in the prior couple of years.
Perhaps this is a question, Mr. Steininger, that you can't address, but I understand the governor has actually designated an individual to sort of oversee a lot of this activity. And my question would be whether that individual is going to be housed here in Juneau during session or whether that individual is going to be elsewhere relative to, you know, maybe a more distant working relationship with the legislature.
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, you know, we're definitely, you know, here to work with the legislature to make sure that we have what we need in order to execute on these programs. And so, you know, if a meeting is necessary with, you know, to discuss these, you know, we'll make ourselves available, whether that's, you know, via phone, teleconference, video, or in person.
Representative Edgeman?
Yeah, and my final point would be that, you know, I find it, and I'll use some strong words here, dramatically underwhelming that the focus and the inertia of this entire session has not been more concentrated around this generational opportunity afforded Alaska with all this money coming through. Again, thank you, Congressional Delegation, and Senator Murkowski for helping with a bipartisan working group that put all this together. But I'm just, you know, as a you know, finishing sort of editorial comment, I'm surprised. that this is not a bigger deal here in the legislature at this point.
Thank you. Representative Wool, and that no pass. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Back on page 18, the $30 million for community assistance deposit from the power cost equalization. If I remember correctly, that community assistance program was always funded out of UGF, and I'd like to try to figure out how that the power cost equalization earnings of $30 million should possibly be used to reduce the need for power cost equalization in communities in rural areas. Some of that money could go to make renewables with windmills or whatever, you know, or a lot of those communities have deteriorating storage tanks, and they could have bigger storage tanks to reduce their fuel costs in the wintertime. So that was just a comment I have. Was I wrong in my where that money used to be and how it used to be utilized, or what's we got going?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the $30 million is based on the statutory formula and waterfall of how PCE earnings should be used. So first, it covers the PCE program itself at about $32 million, and then makes a deposit into the Community Assistance Fund, and then supports other programs like you're talking about that would invest in infrastructure throughout the state. And so all of those needs are, or all of those designations are covered in our budget. In the capital budget is where you'll see further use of PCE per that calculation to cover energy programs with like Alaska Energy Authority and such.
Follow up.
So the earnings of the PCE, is it in statute that it would the earnings would be used for community assistance or not?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, yes, the $30 million is a statutory designation of PCE. So this is following the statutory guidelines of the use of that fund.
Okay, thank you.
And just to follow up on that, there is sufficient amount from the waterfall to pay the $30 million. So, for example, I think usually what the PCE payment is, I don't know, like $42 million or something like that. That means that there's an extra $30 million on top of that to pay from PCE into this, from those PCE earnings?
Chair Foster, yes. The fund earned enough not just to satisfy the entire waterfall, but even have more after that point, which has not been appropriated. It just stayed, those excess earnings stay in the fund.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay, I don't have anything else. Any other comments? I don't see any. We are almost on time, so did okay. And do you have any final comments, Mr. Steiniger?
No, thank you for the opportunity today, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We I enjoy the robust discussion. I think we've got big choices in front of us, and it's good to have some push and pull, and at the end of the day, hopefully we'll have a nice refined product here. With that, our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, January 21st at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting, we'll hear an overview and evaluation of the Governor's FY23 budget by the Legislative Finance Division. So if there's nothing else to come forward the committee, we will be adjourned at 3:39 p.m. Thank you.